You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, I am Jessica Matthews, president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to this important session this morning. This is a great occasion for us to hear from the eye of the storm how the outlook of the international financial crisis looks, both with respect to burdens on national economies and national policymaking, but also with respect to the new burdens that have been added on international collaboration to address the crisis. And to hear from the IMF itself, from its senior economic counselor and director of research, Olivier Blanchard, based on the newly published World Economic Outlook, how the crisis looks. As you all know, the G20 emphatically moved the IMF to the center of international policymaking on addressing the crisis with the decision to increase reserves to $750 billion. And the issue of new special drawing rights. And so what the IMF thinks and how it sees the crisis becomes of absolutely central importance. This is a particularly noteworthy event for us as well, because Carnegie, as some of you know, has just launched a new program in international economics, led by Uri Dadush. We have just published one of his first publications, what will be a regular international economic bulletin that draws not only on his knowledge and contacts in Washington, but on the views from the regions, as from Carnegie's offices in Russia, Eurasia, China, the Middle East, and in Europe. And we will be issuing the bulletin at regular intervals with a real emphasis on how the crisis is being felt and seen in the regions. I also want to take this opportunity to particularly welcome our newest staff member, Alejandro Foxley. Where'd he go? There. A name that everybody, I think, knows, the former foreign minister of Chile, and before that, finance minister of Chile, who will be dividing his time between here and home over the coming years, and we are thrilled to have him. He tells me that he has read every page, Olivier, of the report, and gives it an A+. He thinks it's the best such report he's ever read. So it's the only thing that's inflating around here these days. But anyway, let me say how pleased we are to have all three of our panelists with us, and turn the mic over to Uri. I should say that we have a Russian delegation meeting downstairs, and I'm supposed to be chairing that, so I can only stay for a little bit, but I will go back and forth.
Very good. Well, Jessica, thank you very much for that introduction, and I'm especially pleased today to welcome my old friends from the International Monetary Fund, with whom we competed in a friendly way for many years when I was doing this work at the World Bank. But also doubly pleased to welcome Olivier, who we go back quite a while, maybe a little too long, to say. And it's a pleasure to have you with us, and to have this conversation with you on the world in recession. Also joining Olivier in the presentation are two excellent economists, also from the fund, Marco Terrones, who is the deputy division chief in the research department, and Stefan Degninger, who is a senior economist in the World Economic Studies division. Before handing it over to Olivier, let me extend my sympathy to all who are engaged in economic forecasting at the moment, because This is always a difficult art, economic forecasting. But when you are in a situation where world economic activity is plunging at record rates and the stock markets around the world are rising at record rates, that makes it especially challenging. And so I look forward to seeing how a master deals with that particular problem. Go ahead, Olivier.
Thank you. I'm going to speak. Control L. Is it Control L? Control S5? No. Hey, good. Good. Thanks, Uri. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to see you again. What I'm going to do is give you a sense of not the forecasts themselves. You can read them in newspapers, but how we came to the conclusions we came to. And I'm going to start with a slide which sketches the main theme of the world economic outlook. And the way we think about it is that at this stage, and that's very much what Uri was referring to, the global economy is subject to two cross currents, two opposite forces. The first one comes from the financial dislocations and the drop in confidence and the drop in demand, which affected nearly all countries in the last quarter of 2008, which is something that we've never seen. I hope we never see again. But once you have something like this, you have what we nerdy economists call dynamic multipliers, which is that the decrease in demand leads to a decrease in output, which leads later to a decrease in employment, which leads to a further decrease in income, in demand, and so on. And we're very much seeing the dynamic effects of this shock just reverberating around the world. So that force is still very strong and is still pulling us down. Then you have forces pulling the global economy up. In a normal recession, you'd have what we call natural stabilizers, which is once people have not bought cars for a while or have not bought houses, and at some point they need actually to replace the cars, they need housing. And so you basically see these forces eventually dominate. And so far, not much has happened on this front, and the natural stabilizers will probably come, but they haven't quite played the role yet. What has played the role is very aggressive, and rightly so, demand policies, macroeconomic policies, financial policies on the fiscal side, on the monetary side, and so on. So what we're seeing today, and that's where the conflicting signals from the stock market, I think, come from, is a balance between the two. And at this stage, namely first quarter and probably second quarter of this year, there is no question that the force pulling the global economy down is still dominating. It's getting weaker, but it's still dominating. And what we think is that by the end of the year, second semester, the natural stabilizers and the demand policies will start basically offsetting it and dominating, and therefore things will turn around. So our forecast is very much based on this, which is the idea that we have this force pulling down becoming weaker, the force pulling up becoming slowly stronger. This leads us to forecast for advanced economies growth turning positive at the end of 2009, the beginning of 2010, that you realize that the degree of precision here is limited. But that's, I think, the number you should keep in mind. Now, what's important is to realize that positive growth is surely better than negative growth, but it's not enough. What you need, basically, to be on a steady path is growth at the normal rate. We don't quite know what the normal rate will be when we get out of a crisis, but zero is surely not it. And so as long as growth is less than the normal rate, unemployment keeps increasing. This is what we call Hawken's law, and that's a very strong relation, which means that even if growth becomes positive at the beginning of next year, or the end of this year, unemployment will increase so long as growth hasn't gone back to normal. And that's basically one more year out. I think it's a very important message to deliver, because I think when people read newspapers, they may think tomorrow things are going to change. Growth is going to be less negative tomorrow, that's likely, will turn positive, but unemployment is going to increase for a long time, and we have to think about this. Now, all these forecasts are based on some assumptions, obviously, but in particular assumptions about policy. Fiscal policy will continue to be strong, monetary policy will continue to be very aggressive as it has been, but more importantly, we assume that financial measures to repair the financial system will slowly be put in place. We do not assume, it would be unrealistic, that they'll be put in place tomorrow. We understand the process, it's a slow process, but we assume it's happening, and therefore our forecast is based on a steady, if slow, improvement of the financial system. If this did not happen, then we can think of ugly scenarios. Namely, we can think of vicious cycles in which real activity is weaker, leading banks to be weaker, leading banks to cut even more, that we don't want to go there. And then, even if we pass that stage and things will turn around, I think the evidence is that although you can have a recovery without the financial system being in good health, we've seen this in other countries, the recovery is slow, takes much longer, and therefore the speed of recovery is lower, and unemployment keeps increasing for a longer time. So the policy message that we have is that it's very, very, very important to deal with the financial system at this stage. The rest of the presentation is a set of graphs which basically make various of these points more precise, more quantitative. I'll basically just string along and insist on points which I think are useful. The headlines tend to give year-on-year growth rates. This is what you see in newspapers. That's not very useful in an environment in which growth rates change quarterly, very much from quarter to quarter these days. So this is, I think, a better way of summarizing our projections, which if you look at the red line, you see the dark blue is the past, the light blue on the right is what we project, and you can see that we project negative growth, namely growth below zero until the end of 2009, and then it turns positive, but weakly positive. For emerging market countries, basically their recovery depends very much on what happens in advanced countries. They're not going to get out of the woods by themselves. They cannot. They depend on exports too much and on capital flows. And so the pattern is the same. Why is it higher? Well, it's higher because on average, emerging countries have higher growth. So you basically just have the movement of the same curves up. And so they turn positive in terms of growth very soon, maybe even now. But still, it's a growth rate which is much lower than usual for them. The next graph makes the point that I emphasized already, which is that although growth turns around at the end of 2009 in terms of sign, unemployment turns around much later. And the implication of this picture is that we can expect unemployment to crest at more than 10% in a fairly large number of countries, and we have to think about that. Let me give you a sense of these two forces I've talked about. You know, these are two forces. What we see is the result. So you have to go a bit beyond the numbers and look for things. But this, I think, shows the strength of what happened in the 2008 fourth quarter. So what you have here, let me just focus on emerging markets on the right. What you have here are our forecast in yellow as of January 2009, and then in red you have our current forecast. Now, what's interesting is that the forecast in January were presumably based on some information about 2008, but the information we had then and the information that the world had at the time was that, yeah, it had been a bad quarter, but nothing catastrophic, as you can see. Based on what we knew in January, we thought that the previous quarter had had a decrease in output of minus 1.5% at annual rates. Well, it turns out, now that we have better numbers, that the decline was actually much larger, was three times larger. And that's the same thing in advanced countries. What happened in 2008 was a collapse, which took a while to be perceived, and is still very much playing out. So this shows you the strength of the first shock, of the first force. Let me now spend the rest of the time on the forces eventually pulling things up. Natural stabilizers. In principle, you would expect that, you know, builders would stop building houses and the stock of inventories, the stock of housing would basically go up initially and then come down and that would stabilize things. Eventually, on the left, you see the total inventories of housing, and basically, although it has come down a bit, it's still very high. It's not playing much role in terms of stimulating housing. We're still quite away from it. On the right, you have automobile sales, and again, you would expect inventories to go up initially and then to decline, and then automobile producers to start producing more, sales picking up. And as you can see, except for the very last point, data point, it's still very, very weak. So these things have not played much of a role yet. But as things go, and unless something bad happens, they should play an increasing role. What has played a major role is the set of policies which have been taken. So let me go through the list, fiscal, monetary, financial, and then I'll be done. Fiscal policy. A lot has been done. We, at the fund, very early on, I think, in the crisis, said, look, private demand is going to be very low. You have to do something. You basically have to increase public spending and give tax breaks. Where are going to have an effect? We suggested a discretionary impulse, measures to basically do things, of about 2% of GDP. Ex post, it turns out that it will be 2%. I don't think that countries followed us to the letter, but the result is very much what we expected. You have this, you also have automatic stabilizers, especially in Europe, where basically when activity falls, tax revenues fall, and therefore people get tax breaks automatically. When you want to think about what happens overall, you have to add the two. The picture here shows you what happened in 2000, what is happening in 2009, what we expect will happen in 2010. The major point, large increase in deficits, large fiscal stimulus, not much difference between the US and Europe. The difference in composition, in the US, the automatic stabilizers are smaller, discretionary stronger, but the net result is very, very similar. So very strong fiscal effort, and it's showing up in the data already. The big issue here is whether more should be done, and here we're getting to a delicate point, and that shows very well on the right-hand side. You basically have for the G20 advanced countries what the baseline path is for public debt. So in 2007, for this group of countries, public debt was roughly about 80% of GDP. This is the blue line you have on the right. And under the baseline, we expect it to go to 110. Large differences across countries, but still, it's useful to look at the average. If growth is a bit lower than we expect under the baseline, which is our adverse scenario, then debt might go to 130% of GDP. And the governments have a lot of contingent liabilities. They have guaranteed many of the debts of the financial system. But suppose they actually have to pay, which might happen in an adverse scenario, then we think debt would easily go to 150% of GDP. This raises the issue, which is that when you increase spending today further, financial markets start worrying a whole lot about the future. And although this is worrisome, it has a direct effect, which is that they increase the long interest rates on you. And so what you gain on one hand by spending more, you're losing by the adverse effect of interest rates. And I think the implication at this stage is fiscal policy should still be very aggressive, but has to be done in a medium run context, in which if you do something today, you have to start reforms which improve the medium run, such as healthcare, such as retirement in many, many, many countries. This slide just makes the point, I'm not going to go through it, but basically makes the point that financial markets have started worrying a whole lot about these financial positions, and we cannot ignore it. What you have is the CDS spreads, which is basically the perceived probabilities by markets that the debt, the government debt, will not be repaid for a number of countries. And without going through the list, there are clearly countries where the financial markets are looking and say, I worry. The US is not yet there. It should probably be, because the numbers are not great, but we hope that something will be done. The monetary policy, as you know, monetary policy has been extremely aggressive. The most central banks cut what we call the policy rates more or less to zero. And then they have embarked on what we call credit and quantitative easing, which is instead of intervening in the treasury bill market, they have decided to buy private assets. And the idea here is that we're in a time in which the markets are very dislocated, so that the arbitrage relation between interest rates do not hold. There are markets where the spreads are very large, investors are not there, then the Fed or some central bank can go in and with a limited amount of funds make a big difference to the equilibrium interest rate. And without going into the details again here, what you can see from the left-hand side graph is the effect of now of interventions in two particular markets for commercial paper by the Fed. The point to be made is you have a vertical line in the middle of the graph, white, and you can see that the interest rates, basically on these assets, have decreased very, very much. There is much more to be said here, but in the interest of time, I will pass. The conclusion here is that these policies are non-standard, but they have been proven to be extremely useful. The last point is financial policies, and the question is, well, suppose that the plans to improve the financial system are slower than we assume in the baseline. How bad could things get? This is based on a model that we've been using to think about these issues. Let me, again, give you just a feel for what is done here. What you have on the left is something called the bank lending, BLT, bank lending standard. I don't know what T stands for. I should know. I don't. Anyway, it's a survey of senior loan officers. And basically, it's above zero. It means that more of them are tightening than loosening. So any number above zero means tightening. And as you can see from the yellow line, there has been steady tightening since the beginning of the crisis. What we assume in our baseline forecast is that this will come down, although still for a long time above zero, which means that we expect further tightening, but less and less, and then things turning around. Okay, and the output gap, the difference between actual output and where we could be or we should be, is the yellow line in the graph on the right. The point here is that the bottom of the output gap is reached in our baseline scenario at the beginning of 2010. If there was less progress, then we would get the red line on the left-hand side, so bank lending would be tighter for longer, and the output gap would basically be largest 1 year later. So we basically would delay the recovery by 1 year. This is an adverse scenario. You can think of worse scenarios than that, but it indicates that that's very, very important to get banks to start lending again. Last point is the international dimension, and especially what's happening to emerging market countries. For them, it is very much two outside shocks. They didn't sin. They're just affected by what happens in the world in two ways. An enormous drop in their exports. And this affects countries to different degrees, but it's a very, very strong shock. And the other is what we used to call sudden stops, which is a stop in capital inflows. And what's happening here is a combination of two things. First, international investors have become very risk averse, so they tend to take money home, away from emerging markets. And and advanced countries' banks are deleveraging, namely basically cutting lending. And they tend to do this both domestically and to foreigners. And so what has happened is shown in this graph, which is, I think, very, very striking, which shows you the net capital flows for most of the sample here from 2004 to the third quarter of 2008. Net capital flows in emerging market countries were positive. What you saw in the last quarter of 2008 is an enormous change in sign, an enormous decline, very large negative net capital inflows. What this means in practice is that it is becoming increasingly difficult for countries to actually finance their balance of payments needs. If they have a large current account deficit to start with, and if foreigners are not willing to roll over the debt, then it can be very bad. That's something we identified very early on in the crisis. This is why we went for this new lending window called the FCL, which we put in place. This is what led us to try to convince governments that the fund needed more money, and we basically got it, or we got pledges and some of the money already at the G20 meeting. We think now that with the amount of money which has been pledged to us, this will be sufficient to basically facilitate the adjustment in both countries. Will be able to basically lend them the funds that they need. They still have to do an adjustment to the world. The world will not be the same in the future as it was in the past, but will facilitate the adjustment very much. Let me just conclude. I think the green shoots part is right. There are signs that things are turning around, as I've explained. But I'm worried that the message is that things are fine. And I think the first message from us is really that the need for strong policies is still extremely strong, is still acute. With these policies, as I've said, I think we'll basically see positive growth starting next year. We'll see unemployment crest at the end of next year. For emerging and developing countries, what's going to happen to them in the end is going to depend on what happens in advanced countries. They'll turn around with us and then recover with us. Last point, which is going to be what we'll have to think about when things improve, if they do, is exit policies. There's a long list of things we have to think about. I think the fiscal implications are at the top of my list, but there are many others. Thank you very much.
Would you like us to...
We should probably have a presentation.
Just go to the next presentation. Thank you very much, Olivier. That was terrific. And so, Marco Terrones, I think, is going to speak next.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Uri, for inviting us to present our work. In the next few minutes, I'm going to present the main findings of the Chapter 3 of the World Economic Outlook. The chapter was entitled From Recessions to Recovery, How Soon and How Strong. This is joint work with Prakash Kanan and Alice Dare Scott, and we had the support from Gavin Asdorian and Emory Oaks. Let me briefly introduce the chapter. As all of you know, the world economy is facing a severe recession. Employment losses and output losses are mounting by the day. And also, we have seen a decline in trade and capital inflows around the world. Okay. There are two aspects of these recessions. The first aspect is that these recessions are associated with financial crisis. And the second aspect is that all these recessions are globally synchronized around the world, okay? So basically what we are trying to do in the chapter is to answer three basic questions. Are recessions and recoveries associated with financial crisis different from others? That's the first question we're going to address. The second question we'll try to address is what are the main features of globally synchronized recessions and how do the recoveries look like? And the third and last question we'll be addressing in this chapter is can countercyclical policies help shorten recessions and strengthen recoveries? In order to address these three questions, we examined the business cycles in 21 advanced economies since 1960. Okay, so what we do first is first we find the turning points, the cyclical turning points in each of the 20 advanced economies. Once we have identified the cyclical turning points, we identify the periods of recessions and the periods of expansions. And then we find their properties, like, for instance, the duration. The duration is how much it takes to go from peak to trough. Peak to trough defines a recession. And also the amplitude, how much output drops from peak to trough. So those are the two basic statistics we are going to be estimating in what follows. When we have identified the turning points, we get to 122 recessions in these economies since 1960. 15 of these 122 recessions were associated with financial crisis, and 37 of these 122 recessions were globally synchronized. These recessions were centered about three main dates, in 1975, 1980 and 1992. So those are the two periods where the recessions were globally synchronized in the past. Finally, there were six recessions that were both associated with financial crisis and at the same time were globally synchronized. As you can see, the latter part of these kind of recessions where you have the two components are very rare, okay? So we have the recessions, and then, as I mentioned to you, the next step is to find the features of the recessions, and one of the main features is the duration of the recessions. And also, what we do is to find how much time it takes to output to recover to the previous peak. So remember, recessions starting in a peak and ending in a trough, and then the recovery goes from trough to the old peak. So that's how we are going to try to estimate some of the features. In the next slide, what we show you is the duration of recessions and recoveries. Recessions are in the left-hand side of the slide, and recoveries are on the right-hand side. And we present there different types of recessions. The very first bar on the charts present you the duration of all recessions and their corresponding recoveries. Usually, it's about 1 year, 2 years duration. No, it's about one year, less than 1 year. Usually, the typical recessions last less than 1 year. Okay, so that's what the first chart is showing to you. Then you see that the recovery from these recessions in the right hand side, the recoveries tend to be fast, and the time it takes to go from the peak where you started to recover the level takes about 6 quarters. So that's 1 year and a half. Okay, so usually, in the typical case, you have this kind of V-shaped situations. You know, you have a quick recovery. Okay, now when we move to the recessions associated with financial crisis, we see that recessions tend to last longer than the typical recessions, and they usually last almost 1 year and a half. In the left-hand side, in the second bar, you have the blue component. That's what takes the other kind of the time it takes the average recessions, and the red bar shows the additional time associated with this kind of recessions with financial crisis. So the purpose of doing this is to show that these recessions tend to be longer, and also the recoveries are longer. As you can see in the right-hand side, the recoveries of the recessions associated with financial crisis tend to last almost 10 quarters, as you can see in the right-hand chart. Finally, when you examine the recessions that are at the same time associated with financial crisis and that are globally synchronized, you find that they are much longer yet. So they are last almost 2 years, as you can see in the left-hand side, the last bar. And obviously, the recoveries also tend to be weak. And you can see that the recoveries almost last around 14 quarters. Okay, so the message coming out from these charts are very powerful. What these charts are telling us is that situations like the ones we are now facing are very worrisome, because the recessions that we could be facing could be very long, and they could be very severe. Okay? Now, one of the questions that one may ask is that why is it that recessions associated with financial crisis tend to be more costly than other recessions? And for comparison, in the next slide, what we have done is to present how the recessions associated with financial crisis compared with all other recessions. In the left-hand side, you have the recessions associated with financial crisis with the red line. And all other recessions, they are portrayed with the yellow line. And also, we are representing the highly synchronized recessions compared with the other recessions. And in here, what we are having is the behavioral consumption. Okay, the question I postulated was, why is it that recessions associated with financial crisis tend to be more costly? And when one examines what's happening on the onset of the recession, most of these economies face a credit boom. With the credit boom, saving rates tend to decline sharply, and also asset prices increase very sharply. So when at the onset of the recession, what happens is that agents tend to adjust their consumption pattern. As you can see, the consumption in the case of financial crisis tend to decline, and then it remains very flat for the remaining quarters. Okay, that explains that behavior is explained because consumers want to reveal their savings rates, and also they want to deleverage, so they start paying debts, and they are fixing their financial situation. So the main reason why a financial crisis tend to be costly is this one, the effects that it has on consumers. Also, it has a similar effect on the firms. Now, notice that highly synchronized recessions also have some effect on consumption, but after the seventh quarter, consumption starts picking up. Okay, so in the two cases, consumptions play a big role. If you examine the regular recessions, in their consumption falls very slightly and recovers also very fast. So in here, consumption is playing a big role. Now, this behavior in consumption is reflecting what's happening with asset prices, in particular with house prices. As I mentioned to you, in the run-up to the recession, these economies were facing a credit boom, and asset prices were increasing above their fundamentals. And once the recessions come into place, the asset prices tend to fall. Notice how house prices falls in the case of financial crisis. It's a sharp drop, and it's a long-lasting drop. Okay, you can have a situation where the process of economic recovery starts and house prices continue falling. That's what the first chart in the left-hand side is showing to you. You know, recovery starts, usually recovery starts in the trough, in the red line, red dotted line that you have there, and you see that asset prices continue falling. Now, one big component in the process of recovery, or one factor that leads to recovery in most of the advanced economies, has been the behavior of exports. Notice when you have the situation, when you have recessions associated with financial crisis, and you compare with all other recessions, notice that the behavior of exports is very similar. Okay, that means that exports don't suffer much when you have a situation of financial crisis. Contrast this with what's happening in the case of highly synchronized recessions in the right-hand side. Notice that in the case of highly synchronized recessions, exports fall and then recover only late, and not compared with what's happening with the other recessions, where exports is pulling the economies out of the recession. So that means that in the typical case where you have recessions associated with financial crisis, exports tends to help recovery. But when you have both cases, when you have recessions associated with financial crisis and that are globally synchronized, there is no exports to pull these economies out of the recession. So that's the main message coming out from this slide. Now, will ask next whether can policy help in this kind of situation. In order to address this question, what we have done is to examine what happens with the duration of the recessions when governments implement expansive monetary and fiscal policy. In here, what we are going to look at is to the discretionary part of these policies. In this chart, what we show is the probability of remaining a recession beyond a given certain numbers. You have three lines there. The blue line represents what happens in the typical recession. And the red line is the probabilities of exiting recessions in the case where you have recessions associated with financial crisis. Notice that the probabilities tend to be, the probabilities of exiting a recession tend to be lower or higher in the case of the typical case than in the case of the case where you have financial crisis. You know, the red line shows you the probabilities in the case where you have financial crisis, and the blue case or the blue line shows you the normal case. Okay, what we have done next is to try to see what is the impact of policies with respect to these probabilities. So when we run regressions estimating survival functions, what we find is that both fiscal and monetary policy tend to help reduce the duration of the recession. Okay, so they shift the blue line to the left. Okay. But the effects of fiscal policies tend to be not statistically significant. Okay, so monetary policy seems to be very powerful in this case, but the effects of fiscal policy are not statistically significant. However, when we run the same kind of regressions, when in the case where we have recessions associated with financial crisis, what we find is the opposite, that fiscal policies tend to be very powerful in terms of reducing the probability of increasing the probability of exiting a recession, and the effect of monetary policy is not. Okay, and now these results are consistent with previous literatures where they found that fiscal policy tends to work when agents are have liquidity constraints. Okay, and also the lack of effect from the monetary policy in the case of recession associated with financial crisis is due to the fact that the transmission mechanisms are broken when you have financial crisis. Okay, so the results are fairly intuitive. Okay. The second thing we did was to examine how fiscal and monetary policies help to the strength of the recovery. Remember the recovery starts in the trough to see what happens with the output growth 1 year after the trough, okay? So what we have done is run similar exercises, and what we have found is that both monetary and fiscal policy tend to help the strength of the recoveries, okay? Now, then the next question was to ask whether the sustainability of fiscal policy matters or not in this case or for the effects. So what we did is to introduce an interaction term where we have the fiscal policy, which in some of the regressions we have proxy with increases in government expenditures, and in other ones with primary balance. When we interact with the level of public debt, what we have seen is that the effectiveness of fiscal policy tends to decline as the level of public debt increases. That means that the issues of sustainability of fiscal policy are key when one is framing the fiscal stimulus in these situations, okay? So this chart here shows you how the effectiveness of fiscal policy tend to decline with the level of debt. At some levels, you have negative effects, okay? The higher the level of public debt, the effects on growth of fiscal policy tend to be negative. Okay. Now, what we did is to examine how the current recessions look like, and whether we find elements that lead us to think that these recessions are going to be more severe than the typical recessions. So. In the next chart, we present several aggregates where we show the behavior of the of several macroeconomic variables in the United States, and we compare with the typical cases, which is the average of what has happened in the OECD countries. That shadow or that 50% interval of previous recessions represents what typically happens in recessions in all the OECD, excluding United States. Notice that in most of the charts, the lines for United States are away from the typical behaviors. Okay, so again, this confirms that perhaps we are headed to a very severe recession. And also notice that the behavior of several financial variables in all in credit, house prices, and equity prices, all of them are also off the chart. You want, meaning that this recession seems to be very peculiar. And also notice what the monetary authority has been doing, you know, extreme efforts from the monetary authority, and also the fiscal authority has been stimulating the economy. Okay, so what's the policy message of this chapter? The policy message is that the current recessions are likely to be long lasting and severe, and the recoveries are going to be very weak. And second, the monetary and fiscal policy can help reduce the duration of the current recessions and strengthen the economic recovery. So it's very important that the authorities keep on helping the economy towards the process of recovery. Thank you.
Thank you very much again for that very thorough review of this episode against the background of a long experience with different types of crisis. And so next I'm going to ask Stefan to present, and then we're going to open it up for questions, comments.
Just open this. So this is the complementary chapter, the fourth chapter that deals with mostly the effects on emerging economies. And to set the stage, let me just motivate this presentation with this chart. This is the level of stress in advanced economies. And what you see here is the scale of the crisis currently. What is stacked up are the number of countries that are under high financial stress currently. Number one is 100% currently. And you can sort of look back in history among advanced economies through different crises, and you see that the scale in terms of the number of countries and regions involved in advanced world and also the duration is unprecedented. What matters or what we care about for emerging economies, especially since we're talking about the financial sector in advanced economies, is implications on capital flows. Sharp and rapid drop-offs, or also called sudden stops, can have very strong negative effects on emerging economies and has been associated with crisis. And I think we've seen the chart earlier. There has been a sharp drop-off, and in fact, if you read the Financial Times this morning, the BIS just released the quarter four numbers of bank lending with a very shocking decline in bank lending liabilities of Western, of advanced economies banks, especially Western European banks. What we have here is a look maybe ahead in the first quarter, which we don't know yet, and there seems to be a little bit of an uptick. These are specific part of capital flows, syndicated loans, corporate international bonds. So that it's not quite clear where we stand. And this is like the background of the chapter, asking the question, really, how severe is the crisis on the financial sector in the emerging economies? And in general, sort of like taking that a step further, how strongly are, in general and in the current crisis, emerging economies affected by the advanced economies, with financial markets being sort of like the conduit through which these capital flows are being channeled. And given that we know that in the current crisis, banking sector is so strongly affected in advanced economies, does that make it more severe for emerging economies? Finally, what are some sort of like post-policy or remedies that emerging economies can look at? How do we go about this? Well, we first develop a measure, which is our emerging market economy financial stress index. It captures different aspects of the financial sector. It's not only the banks. The banks is an important component. We look at the exchange market. Exchange market pressure is countries depreciating? Are there reserve losses? What about spreads on sovereign debts on the capital markets? And also look at stock markets and stock market returns. And we look at this on a monthly level for a set of about 25, 27 economies. And we sort of try to gauge how far out away from sort of like a normal state, with sort of like being having a positive number, meaning you're away in terms of sort of like a lower exchange rate, a depreciated exchange rate, or a lower performing bank, or stock market returns being lower. So a higher number means more stress. And this is what we see. So that the purple bars is the aggregate average index for emerging economies. And the one thing to point out is that if you compare to the last large regional crisis, around the Asian crisis, then it spread to Russia as well and Brazil, if you remember, then currently levels of stress, or at least at the end of the last year, were already exceeding these levels. And we plotted next to it the index, it's the thin line for advanced economies. And you can see there's a strong co-movement, and also that for advanced economies, the peak is much higher than anything advanced economy has happened in the past. Looking at the aggregate, it does not reveal, obviously, where stress is located. And one might think, well, possibly it's really driven by emerging Europe. But when you look at the regional aggregates, you see there's actually been quite some synchronized movement of the financial stress index. And it's not just that one or the other region was affected. Markets in Asia, as well as Latin America, as well as in emerging Europe, have seen a strong increase in stress. As a next step, we try to understand how does transmission work from advanced to emerging economies. And what we're particularly interested in is that long vertical arrow going from the bottom up. How large, how intensively is stress responding? Are financial markets responding in emerging economies? And are there sort of like factors that influence this co-movement, this rate of transition? We also want to control for that. Well, usually when there's stress in advanced economies, other things are going on, like growth is declining. So to control for that and disentangle these effects. So what you see in the next chart is a representation of on a country-by-country basis of that responsiveness of the co-movement of individual countries with stress in advanced economies. And what you see, the two points to take home is that on average, that's the red line, the response is close to one. So if there's a stress impulse in advanced economies, most emerging economies respond very strongly. The second one to take home is, while it's not that all countries vary at the same rate, there's clearly some differentiation that takes place. Just to sum up what the findings, what we came up with, if you look at what determines the variation of these betas, of this responsiveness of stress, then what really drove in the last crisis the transmission was a country's bank linkage to advanced economies banks. So if you've been borrowing a lot from advanced economies banks, you've been affected, your financial markets have been affected more. And the chart on the left bottom side sort of gives you an intuition why this may be the case. It shows you what the bank lending liabilities of different emerging regions are. At the bottom you have emerging Asia, emerging Europe, and so on. And the one that stands out is the second one, which is emerging Europe, which has borrowed quite massively. It's to the average tune of 50% of emerging Europe's GDP in terms of the stocks. And the biggest contributor are Western European banks. And we know that they there's a lot of stress in Western European banks. So it's in a way not surprise that we've seen sort of like a lot of stress in emerging Europe relative to other regions, because sort of like that sort of like there was the strongest link in the last period. Now, about policies, can economies insulate themselves from this transmission? And basically, and that this was a bit to our own surprise, really insulation does not work. What we tried to do is we analyzed what happens to emerging economies when the global economy, the advanced economies are in stress. And what you see is that the red bar, the first bar, is this is what happens in these periods of duress in the advanced economy. There's a big increase in financial stress index. And then the question is, so how does it vary across countries? What are the contributing factors? And the one that dominates throughout all economies is advanced economy stress. It's just driving what happens in emerging economies. You can have good policies in place, but the marginal effect in terms of reducing the stress that you experience or that economies experience is small in times of when the global economy is in crisis. It's different if there's a global calm. There's much more differentiation than possible, having improved current account balances, fiscal balances, and high reserves helps then, but it does not help you to avert a transmission. leaves the question, how come that in Latin America or in emerging Asia we haven't seen as much of a turmoil yet? Well, you had buffers there. The financial markets responded, but you could fend some of it off through aggressive policy moves, since you sort of came from a position of strength, especially in Latin America. The same with reserves. There were reserve buffers in place, but there's only so much one could do. So looking forward, the question is, what is the outlook for these emerging economies of a resumption of capital flows through the normal channels? And this is sort of like the last point to make is, we looked at case studies. What happened to emerging economies when the advanced economies, there were investors in these economies, when they had a systemic banking crisis or financial sector crisis? And there were two cases that we looked at. That's the United States in the 1980s. And that was sort of like as a response after the Latin American debt crisis. A lot of U.S. banks got hit very strongly, and what happened to them afterwards. And the second example is the Japanese banking crisis in the 1990s and their involvement in emerging Asia. And I just want to highlight the first one. Basically, U.S. banks pulled out quite a bit stronger than other advanced economies from Latin America in the 1980s. The reason to why to emphasize is because there are quite interesting parallels to Western Europe right now, where you have Western European banks being quite strongly involved in emerging Europe. And the blue line in both charts shows you sort of like the decline of capital flows or liabilities in that sense from banks into the Latin American region, and that decline was quite long-lasting, over 10 years in that example. I'll skip that. Just to wrap up, so basically financial market very fast-moving, emerging economies get affected quite substantially by crisis in advanced economies. What matters seems to matter most for transmission is how tightly you're linked through your financial markets. Trade linkages may matter too, but in that case, financial market is, especially bank linkages, mattered in the last crisis. The option to defend yourself through having good policies in place doesn't fend off that the crisis comes to your country, but it may give you some room to smooth the impact in the first period. And finally, over the long run, given that there's a banking crisis in advanced economies, the outlook for a resumption of capital flows is not very good, not very good one. In terms of what does that mean for emerging economies and what can they do? Well, I think on an individual basis, there's little to be gained. What has to be done is sort of like what can be done should be done in a coordinated basis. I think what's at the forefront or at the foremost importance is to avoid sort of like a second round of deleveraging, so that Western banks do not sort of like are forced or considering withdrawing out of a deterioration in emerging economies, since they are under pressure to improve their balance sheets. And this has sort of like more different angles to it. The one is providing official support to emerging economies, but at the same time, it is in the interest also of emerging economies that advanced economies clean up their financial sectors quite rapidly. And I think there is probably a case for more cooperation between the home and host supervisors. Beyond the near term, looking sort of like through a period of sort of like normalization, I think if you want to keep the level of financial integration that has been generating a lot of growth actually in the past for emerging economies, there have to be systems in place that economies can draw on. And I think these financial support systems, like the currently, I think that the flexible credit line that the IMF has put in on the table, I think is one of these mechanisms that could help keep emerging economies engaged in the global integration process. Thank you.
Thank you very much again. Let me open it up, but before doing that, we've heard a lot. I just wanted to bring out a couple of points. One is the central point that there are big forces continuing to pull us down, as well as forces that are pulling us up, and it's possible to get virtuous circles or it's possible to get vicious circles. And therefore, the role of policies at this juncture is absolutely critical so that we can move to a high equilibrium rather than to a low equilibrium. Well, one way to think about it is we're in a little bit of a knife edge. And hence the contradiction between what you see in the financial markets that are sort of feeling fairly euphoric at the moment and the real numbers, which are continuing to look very bad with some weak exceptions, some scattered exceptions. And the other presentations also were very pertinent. The presentation about the length and depth of financial crisis-induced recessions, again, underscoring the importance of policies in coming out. And finally, a presentation about financial stress, which illustrated, I think, remarkably well just how powerless, in a sense, the emerging markets are in the face of financial turmoil in the industrial countries, that everybody gets affected, and that policies only give you so much shelter from financial stress, at least in the short term. These are some of the points. The fact that this is likely to be a protracted episode, continue to be, it's already been quite protracted, at least in the United States, but is likely to be protracted, particularly in emerging markets, and the capital flow reversals is likely to be protracted. Very, very important set of messages coming out of these presentations. There are a lot of eminent commentators, economists, analysts in the room. I look forward to their comments. I look forward to their questions. Yes, sir. Please introduce yourselves.
Andrei Larionov, Cato Institute. First of all, thank you very much for these very interesting presentations. I have actually a number of questions / comments, and I would, if you may, I'll just mention some of them, and just I would really appreciate if anyone from the panel, maybe all of you, would be able to comment. One is just observation. It does not look like the crisis that we usually call global crisis, it does not look like really global. Even in these paper that has been produced by the fund recently, it demonstrates that not all countries actually do have negative economic growth rate. And even some small group of countries, definitely small, not huge, but small group of countries, actually even accelerated growth rates in year 2009 compared to year 2008. So that is why to call it global in the sense that every country, it's not completely correct, that it's really some kind of effect, the global rate, or the rate of the world economy, it's true, but not each country has been affected. So that is why it leads to the question, why not all countries have been affected? And what makes those countries that happen to be like exception, why are those countries exception? Another issue that would be closely related to this first issue, that even some time has been spent and attention has been attracted to the emerging market economies, on average looks like that emerging market economies are doing slightly better than advanced economies. And these examples of Latin America, Middle East, Africa have been mentioned as well. And they are on average, at least so far, are doing slightly better than advanced economies. It also makes very interesting why. Another issue, because there was a talk about this transmission mechanism between advanced economies to emerging market economies, but nothing has been said about the opposite transmission mechanism. Because if we look in dynamics of some countries, we can see that some emerging markets economies are doing coming to the crisis earlier and coming out of crisis earlier than advanced economies. For example, a number of those countries already are coming out in the late in December or January, December last year, January this year, while US is still in the crisis. So it's once again why it is so, and it looks like it's slightly different. My probably last question or comments would be, I'm sorry, but just, it would be about the policy action, especially since John Williamson is here. I would really appreciate your comments on the Washington consensus, because it looks like that openness happened to be not a very good factor for those economies, and fiscal stimulus as well as monetary easing have been recommended to many countries, which does not look to me exactly going along the Washington consensus. What is not right, policies or reality?
It's very interesting. Please keep your questions, one or two questions, and
can I
short.
Time as we go along, or I'd rather do that
rather than. You would rather do that. Choose. All right. Let me, Olivier, because the audience has been sitting quiet for a while. Let me give them a chance to ask two or three things, and let me turn next to the person responsible for this whole mess, John Williamson, who coined the Washington Consensus.
Yeah, you've heard who I am. I don't want to talk about the Washington Consensus. I want to say, Olivia, that I think the presentation is excellent as regards the short term. I think we all are indebted to the IMF for the lead it's given in analyzing this crisis. And I have no criticism of the short term, but I do worry about the medium term. Let me mention two things that really worry me about your presentation. Or about the world economic outlook. One is the idea that you define a return to normality as simply returning to the previous growth rate of the world economy. That's surely not right. I mean, there's going to be something like 10% lost potential output as a result of this crisis, and that needs to be made up before one return to a normal growth rate before one gets back to equilibrium. The second problem I have is with apparently you make no attempt to extrapolate balance of payments positions, the impact of exchange rate changes. I mean, if you look at apart from Saudi Arabia, I think it's true that the database projections of the balance of payments are essentially the same as if you extrapolate the 2009 predictions. I mean, the differences of 2012 versus 2009 are peanuts for most countries, and that includes the United States, in which there was a big appreciation in the second half of last year. And surely one expects that to lead to a big deterioration in the U.S. current account rather than the picture you have in the database of it continuing to fluctuate at around 3% for GDP deficit.
To take two more and then turn back to the panel. Let me ask Desmond and then Alejandro to comment. I'll come back to you, Peter. I have you on my list.
Firstly, I should just say that I really enjoyed those presentations, which were excellent. But building up on John Williamson's point, I was just wondering whether you could comment on the risk of deflation. You know, looking at your charts, what you've got is you've got enormous output gaps developing in 2009. And I noticed that those output gaps don't disappear until around about 2012. So my question is, do we really have a deflation risk that we've got to be worried about? My second question really relates to the weaker countries in the Eurozone. I'm thinking of Ireland, Greece, Spain, Portugal, Italy, and so on. My question there is, what is the IMF's advice to those countries, you know, facing deep recessions with their public finances blowing out? You know, are you suggesting that those countries tighten fiscal policy in those kind of circumstances, you know, which to me would just look to be pro-cyclical?
Yes, I'm concerned about the what a post-crisis agenda would look like, particularly for middle-income countries. Most of middle-income countries in Eastern Europe, East Asia, Latin America, most of them have done a relatively good job in terms of the basic policies undertaken in the last 15, 20 years. And yet I find some surprising conclusions or semi-conclusions in the report. For instance, in East Asia, it says that one of the vulnerabilities is too much reliance on exports. And secondly, too much reliance on manufactured exports. Well, we used to think that their exports are a good thing, and diversifying exports is even better. In Eastern Europe, you find, again, one of the commentaries in the report is that they did too much manufacturing export to the European Union. We used to think that having a huge market guaranteed for your manufacturers would provide a good force for higher growth and so on and so forth. And then it happens that the opening up of the capital account for East European economies, which is something that has been highly recommended in the past, produced this short-term foreign lending, excessive foreign lending, and now the need to try and get rid of this excessive lending by foreign banks in East European countries. So opening up of the capital account seems to be questioned. Now, in Latin America, the report says, be careful if you rely too much on commodities exports. Okay, so how do we get out of that? What's the medium-term strategy to diversify? If we diversify too much and we get too much into manufacturing exports, any other time that the developed countries go into a recession, we will be hurt very seriously. So what should we do? Secondly, if you look at Mexico and Central America, again, it's similar to Eastern Europe. If you rely too much in one market, the US, it seems that you will be hit much harder. So If these are the open questions, which seem to question all the conventional wisdom that we inherited from the past, what should be a post-crisis agenda for these middle-income countries?
Well, excellent. So, Olivier, you have a set of very easy questions. Exactly. I turn them to you.
In order probably not do justice. First, is it a global recession? Yes, it is a global recession. I'm actually not aware of a country which will have higher growth in 2009 than in 2007. Some countries are doing better than others in terms of growth rates, in particular, say, China and India. But we know that for China, it's an enormous decrease in the growth rate. And for India, it comes from the fact that the shock that you have depends very much on your exposure in terms of your export to GDP ratio, your openness, and your openness in capital markets. And on both fronts, India is an economy where internal demand plays a major role and where there has been fairly substantial capital controls. So they are less exposed to the crisis. But even India has a fairly substantial decrease in its growth rate. Now you say the emerging market countries are going to have positive growth before advanced countries. That's completely right. That the first slide I showed you just comes from the fact that on average they have much higher growth. So although they are just following exactly the same pattern, they are just basically up by 3 or 4% relative to advanced countries, but they are doing in relative terms just as badly, or in many cases much worse. On the Washington consensus, I'll let John Williamson answer questions, but I'll make the following point, which was made very clear by one of the slides presented in the third presentation, which is that we changed the advice we gave on fiscal and monetary policy in this crisis, and I think the answer is typically when you go into a country in trouble, you worry about capital flows, and in general, capital flows are likely to respond very much to the fiscal position of the country and the domestic interest rate. So that if you think that increasing the domestic interest rate or tightening fiscal is going to basically have a major impact on capital flows, then although you don't like it, you have to say that's what needs to be done. This crisis is very different. The elasticity of capital flows to domestic measures, just such as fiscal policy or monetary policy or the policy rate, is not zero, but it's much smaller. Basically, once a bank has decided to close an office in a country, it closes it kind of no matter what the domestic interest rate is. And so I think this time, this means that you should use these instruments less than in a normal or traditional crisis, and you can let some countries have a more relaxed fiscal position than would otherwise be the case. So I think the conditions are different, and therefore that's why the advice is different. But I don't think that the general way of thinking has changed dramatically. On John's points are two points, right? I thought I was clear, but maybe not enough, that unemployment was cresting at the end of 2010. Now, cresting doesn't mean that we're back to normal. Then you need basically recovery, which is you need a period of growth above normal for a number of years. And I think the message from the presentations is recovery may be very slow. Because it's traditionally very slow out of a financial crisis. And again, when you think about what the sources of aggregate demand are going to be, you know, U.S. consumers are probably going to save more, and it's not clear exactly who is going to save much less. So it might actually be a fairly slow recovery, and that leads you not to 2012, which would be good news, but 2013, 2014, before you actually get back to the kind of unemployment rate we hope we get back to. So I take the point completely. On the balance of payments, well, the forecasts play under fairly specific rules, but I think the issue of what happens to the current account deficits and surpluses is a fascinating one. In the U.S., clearly, will have to increase its saving rate, and that's likely to lead to a reduction in the current account deficit. Other countries may well have to go in the opposite direction. How this is all going to be played out with fairly substantial adjustments in exchange rates, that's not the focus of the WIO, but that's clearly something that we're thinking about fairly hard. We can return to it. This is an incomplete answer to your question. On Desmond's point on the risk of deflation, that, you know, in my worry list, which is a very long one, it's not number one, but it is clearly in the list. Why do I worry less? Because although the output gap is going to be very large for a long time, the relation between the output gap and inflation seems to break down at very low rates of inflation. If it was the same everywhere, then, you know, the kind of output gaps we're predicting for the number of years we're predicting it would mean that deflation would become -2, -4, -10, -15, and deflation rates of -15% are an absolute catastrophe, and they make the real interest rate adjusted for inflation very, very high. They create all kinds of problems. One of the reassuring lessons of Japan, if there is one, right, Japan from the 90s, is that they clearly had a large output gap for a long time, and they got deflation, but somehow deflation stayed at -1, -2%. Why? I think that's something we have to understand better. It could be an anchoring of inflation expectations. It could be nominal rigidities, which really make it very hard to go below. But if this is what we get, namely deflation of -1, -2% for a number of years, which is worse than our current scenario, but it could clearly happen, that's not the end of the world. -1, -2% makes real interest rates a bit higher, changes the position of the real value of nominal debt, but it's something we can handle. Of all the things we're being, you know, which is being thrown at us, this is not the worst thing which can happen. On what happens in the weaker European countries, in particular those in the Eurozone, you look at a country like Ireland. I mean, it clearly has a very serious problem, which is, there was one slide, and that's, you know, which I didn't talk about, but not only do they have a fiscal problem, a regular fiscal problem, but they have basically guaranteed bank debt on a scale such that if something went wrong, and something may, then they would find themselves with just a very, very large amount of debt. I think the answer here is that to the extent that they do any fiscal expansion at this stage, and they have very limited room, they have to take measures for the medium run. But even that, I mean, this is the general advice, but in the case of Ireland, I think one has to be realistic that in the worst scenario, EU countries would have to come and help. I think that just is, again, under the adverse scenario, probably much worse than Ireland can handle on its own. You can think of other European countries where this would be the same. At this stage, the scope of the problem in some countries is such that they have to get help. We can help, the EU can help. On this, the big issue of post-crisis implications. Now, I don't think that the fund has completely changed its position on openness and others. But so one question is, should basically, there are many people who think, well, first, we're probably going to see a rise in protectionism as a result of this crisis. Is there any argument for reconsidering openness in goods markets? I think what we've learned is that openness comes with great advantages and great benefits, but it exposes you to large shocks, and you basically have ready for it. Does this mean that you should close your economy? My sense, we have to sit down, but the answer will be no. Basically, the benefits are very large. We just have to think about ways of avoiding the cost. Now, does this mean diversification in terms of exports? I suspect the answer is no. I suspect the answer is much more in the direction of insurance. And, you know, I don't have to tell you about how a country which is selling copper might want to insure itself against variations in the price of copper. But it seems to me that's much more of a dimension in which to go. Think about insurance schemes, either precautionary saving schemes as yours, or insurance schemes by basically buying instruments on the financial markets. More can be done here. Again, I think the new window we have created goes in that direction. I don't think it's at all enough to deal with a problem in the medium run, but it can deal with a problem in the short run. But my sense is, we are now more aware of the pluses and minuses, but I would think that in the end, we still want it, except we have to be ready for it. The questions are more on the capital account. You know, and there's this eternal debate about capital controls. And I think it needs to be revisited. It will be revisited whether we want it or not, because many countries are going to say, well, there are these large outflows or these sudden stop in inflows, what can we do?
my sense, we have to revisit the issue. And again, you come from a country which has visited it at various points. One of the things which strikes me, and where maybe we want to actually tell countries that they can do something, is in foreign currency exposure. If you think about what's happening in emerging Europe, it's clear that given the size of the shock they're experiencing, it would be very nice if we could turn the current account quickly by depreciation. But because of the balance sheets they have and the fact that they are, basically they have this very, very large foreign currency exposure, the depreciation may well be perverse and create more problems than actually it solves, which means that that instrument, unless we can restructure that and do fairly drastic things, is not available. It seems to me essential to have that instrument and that it works. And so we probably have to do things ex ante to limit, potentially to limit foreign exposure beyond, to allow it to go to hedging, but not beyond hedging. And there we may want to think about things again. Let me stop here. Take more questions.
Thanks very much. That was very, very clear. Let me just say that, just as a comment, passing comment, that this issue of open short-term foreign currency exposures combined with a fixed exchange rate is, of course, one that we saw in spades back in 1998, 1999, 2000. It was perhaps the headline lesson to be learned from the Asian crisis, and we're seeing it yet repeated again right at the frontier of Europe, supposedly very sophisticated economic management. And so one question maybe for the IMF and others for future discussion is, what is it about the situation that prevents us from learning even the most basic lessons from previous mistakes? And are we just here in academic discussions, or is this actually changing anything, these lessons? Let me don't answer yet, but I come back. I also will ask you at the closing, if others don't ask you, that if you were managing the world, which is close to what you're doing, what would you do differently today? What would you like to see done differently?
I hope we run out of time.
Other questions? Peter, you had a question, yeah.
Thank you. Peter Battaglia, Johns Hopkins Sides. My first question had been discussed to some extent and is related to the first questioner. I was very struck by the fact that the very unequal stress, financial stress transmission charts that you showed, Mr. Deniger. On the high end, you had, I believe, if I remember correctly, Chile and Turkey most affected. At the low end, you had zero, China. Could you explain a bit more what is behind that and what policy lessons we might derive from that? And if you allow me a second question, that's more an inquiry than a question. Has the fund done any analysis on the linkages between household wealths and changes in household wealths and business cycles? One is a stock item and one is a flow item. Mr. Terrones drew attention to the asset prices, housing prices in particular. Housing prices might serve as a proxy for household wealth. But what is really important, and we can measure that, is equity in houses and, of course, net financial assets. Household wealth in the United States is a multiple of GDP. It's 5 or 6 times as high. Variations in household wealth must have an enormous impact on business cycles. What do we know about it? And why don't we never explicitly talk about that in these analyses?
Good questions. Others, yes. The gentleman at the back, and then Leslie, I think it is. Yeah, and then the lady at the back.
How you doing? My name is Ari Eisenstadt. I was just wondering, with Ben Bernanke on record saying that it was monetary policy that was at fault for the Great Depression, I was wondering if in any of your minds that central banking and artificial interest rates weren't at fault for this current financial crisis. I also was wondering if any of you could talk about the prospect of a global currency, what the implications of that would be, how it would be implemented, and how the control of a world currency wouldn't be, the power wouldn't be abused. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, I think it's Leslie.
Leslie Rorton from Reuters. Mr. Blanchard, talk about things being thrown at you. The question is about the impact of the swine flu coming on top of the global recession already. I mean, it's got to, and if, you know, I know it's early days, but do you have any sort of reference on what the impact should be, and if you could, if you were thinking that this might affect the outlook?
Anybody else? No? Gentlemen.
Thank you. I'm Juan Martinez, Economic Counselor of the Embassy of Spain. I just wanted to ask you about something that I saw in the last presentation. About you were saying that the good policies were not insulating some economies. I would like to know, what do you consider good policies, and why do you consider that they should insulate the financial stress to be transferred from the country of origin to another country?
Olivier?
I'll start, but there were at least two questions for Stéphane, and maybe one for Marco. On why didn't we learn from the Asian crisis about foreign currency exposure? I think because it was just too attractive for people to actually do it again, and governments didn't stand in the way. You know, this is related to carry trade. For Hungarians, it looked very attractive to borrow in yen. And they did. So one has basically step in and say, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. And so the question then is a very practical one, which is, what rules do you basically put in place in order to prevent households households to borrow in foreign currency? And do you allow them under some conditions, and do the same thing for corporations? But I think that has to come from regulation. And maybe the second time around, we learn the lesson. There are also costs to doing this. And we have to think about both. On household wealth, I don't know why you said what you said. It is absolutely central to the way economists think and the way the IMF thinks. And basically, I mean, you know, I took macro from Franco Modigliani, and what we learn is consumption is, in the absence of credit constraints, a function of wealth. And when wealth goes down, consumption goes down. So it is, there's absolutely no question that the decline in asset prices and the decline in wealth in 2008 is affecting consumers very much. And you can think of it in different ways. They feel less wealthy, or they want to have a target retirement income in mind, and they now need to. They think they need to save more, but all this comes to the same result. Where I think there's some question is whether the effect of housing wealth is the same as the effect of, say, stock market wealth. And there are some arguments for thinking that the effects of housing wealth may be weaker because your value of your house goes down. The implicit rent that you pay on your house also goes down. But I think these are second-order questions. There's absolutely no question that the decrease in wealth, which is of the order of, I think, 26 trillion at this stage for financial wealth for the world. Yes. Desmond?
It's more high, around about
50. No, I don't think so.
The United States itself is 14.
Yes.
And the United States is a quarter of the
world. There has been an improvement in the stock market. Well, that's how we do things at the IMF, so. anyway, it's a fairly large number, and there's no question that this is affecting consumption investment, and that's very much why there's this force pulling us down. There were questions, I think, outside of the confines of this conference about global currency. On monetary policy, we have a view, I will not repeat it here, but we have a paper which is called Lessons from the Crisis, which basically discusses whether monetary policy is one of the causes of the boom and then the crash. And the short answer is no. On the swine flu, I'm not yet a swine flu expert, but the IMF has been thinking about these issues in the context of a previous scare. And there's a chapter, an appendix in the World Economic Outlook 2005, which discusses the potential economic effects of of SARS. And I refer you to it. I think conceptually it's clear that it may have an effect on the volume of tourism,
for fairly obvious reasons. So some countries are going to be affected. It is partly a reallocation. People who don't go to Mexico City will go to Disney World. But some of them will just not take a vacation. But it is clear that for some countries the effect may be quite drastic. And for the airline industry, the effect is clearly visible. And these companies are not typically in very good shape. And therefore, the danger that this leads to serious problems for some of them is clearly present. Is it something which is potentially of the scale of the economic crisis we have? I think under the information, that we have at this stage, it is a relatively minor event. One has to be careful. I might have said the same thing about the subprime mortgages in the U.S. at some point in the past, but I would still believe that this is not going to be a major issue in economic terms. I'll stop here.
Very good. We have time for one or two more questions before Olivier tells us what he would do if he ruled the world.
I was hoping I had forgotten.
Yes, no. Any other? Sorry. Oh, yes. Sorry.
Answers to the one question about the transmission. I think when you look at the variation, I think the ranking is quite intuitive. Having said that, this is sort of like an average transition rate or transmission rate from 1997 to 2008. And if you look at it carefully, Hungary is all the way on the left, which would surprise anybody who knows what happened to Hungary. But if you split it by time periods, you do see that Hungary really shoots up in terms of the transmission rate. Generally, in emerging Europe, there was no responsiveness in the past, but then I think there has been a change. A more general theme about this is, which we haven't quite understood, and it's probably something we have to look into more carefully, is about this: how do we justify or understand the decoupling or the discussion about decoupling, where there seems to have been some lag for some period of time before the crisis really sort of like spread. And I think that's something we probably need to sort of like explore a little bit further, what happened there. The upshot is the variation itself aligns pretty well with how countries are linked to partners, to investor regions in terms of their exposure, mostly financial, also in trade related, and bank linkages sort of like matter most in the most recent period. And the other question about what are the good policies? Well, the good policies that we looked at, and there are many other ones you can look at, is external balances or current account balances, fiscal balances, and reserve to GDP ratios. And all of them work into mitigating financial stress. However, having them in place as you enter a global crisis that happens outside you does not insulate the financial sector. So it's not that countries sort of like can hope that, oh, our stock market's going to be fine, or our exchange markets are not going to come under pressure. That seems to be the experience, if banks deleverage, they do it on a global scale, and that may differentiate a little bit, but it still is going to be a significant impact if they're for economies.
Good. Let me then, unless there are other questions, ask Olivier for closing comments. I have one residual question, which relates to Marco Terona's presentation. You mentioned that when you have financial crisis, according to your regressions, monetary policy is less effective because the transmission mechanisms break down. How does this square with the emphasis? Sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. Where, did you hear me at the back? Yeah. How does this square with the emphasis current U.S. policy has with the Federal Reserve engaging massively in quantitative easing, also with Christina Romer's findings that we got out of the Great Depression, largely because of monetary stimulus? Not an irrelevant point of view, given that she is the chair of the Council of Chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. If we could relate to that point and elaborate on it, that would be very helpful. And then, Olivier, if you could close. Thank you.
Okay. I think I shall merge the two questions. Yeah. So what would I do if I were in charge of the world? I think I would engage in very specific communication about the path to recovery. I think there's a danger of insisting too much on green shoots on one hand, that things just are improving, and there is the opposite danger, which is to say this is the end of the world and we'll never get out of it. I think that indicating that there's still going to be a few quarters which are going to be difficult, and then we can basically see positive growth and eventually a decrease in unemployment, and be explicit about the timing, is actually very important. In that respect, I think actually most policymakers, especially in the US, are doing a very good job. A very large part of the crisis, and that was, you know, you could just feel it in the last quarter of 2008, was uncertainty, just complete confusion as to what may happen, what economists call Nietzschean uncertainty, just the notion that you didn't know where you were going, so you would stop spending, whether you were a consumer or a firm. I think it's very, very important to indicate to people that there is a path. It's not for sure, obviously, but there is a path. In terms of policies, so let's just go through the list again. Monetary policy, I've been in awe of what most central banks have done in terms of basically being willing to go beyond the normal use of the of monetary policy to basically intervene in more and more markets, in accepting more and more assets as collateral. Central bankers are thought to be conservative. I think in that particular crisis, they have shown that they could be extremely aggressive and for the right reasons and in the right way. So I think monetary policy has been remarkable. I think standard monetary policy, which is using the policy rate, we understand doesn't work because it's at zero, so you can't use it anyway. But even if you could, you're not sure you're going to have much effects. I think credit easing, which is intervening in specific markets, has proven very useful. Quantitative easing, which is intervening, which I think of as intervening in the by buying public assets at the long end of the yield curve, I think the verdict is still very much out on this, whether it actually does much or not. But, you know, why not try it and see whether it works? On fiscal, again, I think that governments were surprisingly quick at doing things. Should they do more? I've said that at this stage, there is a danger in many countries about doing more without doing less in the medium run, and you really have to do both, and that I think that's an important message. The other thing is that the ideal projects in terms of fiscal policy are basically infrastructure projects at this point, because they basically, if you can kind of move forward in time, you can get more spending now, but at the same time, you know, you have less spending later. The problem with this in the traditional recession is that the lags involved are just too long. So when it comes ready, the recession is gone. Well, we have the unfortunate luck of having a long recession so that some of these projects can actually come online in time. I think it's important to think of contingent plans on that in that direction, which is if 2011 or 2011 turned out to be worse than we thought, we should have projects ready. And if we start thinking about it in early 2010, it's too late. And we basically should now think about what is it that we can start if we need to in 2010, in 2011, in 2012. Have them ready, not shovel ready, but brain ready, and ready in all possible dimensions. I think that's an important message. On financial, the IMF view hasn't moved, which is you basically need to remove toxic assets. And by this, I mean what people call the legacy assets. There are more and more loans which are now doubtful. You should not remove everything from the balance sheets, but the old ones. That needs to be done. It's not happening fast enough in most countries. And then you need to recapitalize the banks. And again, we understand the difficulties of it, but that still needs very much to be done. I don't know how much power you gave me. Do I have to deal with Parliament? Do I have to deal with Congress? Do I have to deal with the political realities? That's basically what's stopping in many cases or slowing down the effort. But here, it is essential that it happens.
Well, you have been very statesmanlike. You actually didn't mention, as far as I can remember, a single country. Sorry about this. You actually didn't mention a single country or continent in your response. So I deduce from this that you are very happy with European policies, with Japanese policies, and with U.S. policies across the board. Is that correct?
You're absolutely right that I did not mention any country in my conclusion.
All right, well, look, I'd like us to extend a word of thanks. I think it was a wonderful conversation.